Manuel, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I thank God I'm okay.
Okay.
How is Italy?
We're doing fine. You're on campus, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. How is the situation?
Not bad. We are managing. Everything is going fine.
Margaret, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir.
Okay. Are you in Abuja as well?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah.
So how is the situation in Abuja?
It's going well. They've started allowing movement. Everything is calm. The cases are not as high as Lagos.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
But when you say hi, I think I heard Lagos has like 7,000 cases.
Lagos one is very high. They are the epic center. I think it's up to 7,000.
So you know, high is relative now.
Okay, compared to some other places, even like Italy.
Compared to some other countries, 7,000 is like a very low number.
Yes.
And here in the US, they are counting them in millions now, maybe about 2 million.
And we thank God the death rate is just about 450 or so. It's not very high.
Yeah, but that's still a lot. I mean, is it compared to what was the total number so far?
The cumulative? About 15,000 cases so far.
Okay, 15,000 cases and 450 deaths. Okay. Okay, the ratio is still quite low. Now 0.3. 0.03. Yeah. Ratio, quite good.
Yes.
But, despite that, it's not still... Okay, Mary, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Okay, how are you?
I'm fine, sir, thank you.
So, have you guys been able to watch the videos?
Sir, yes, I have.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay, both of them.
Yeah, I did not finish the yesterday's lecture because we had power issues.
Okay, but on campus, you have power issues?
Yes, they normally on the gen from 8 to 11, then from 3 to 5. Then after that, from 7 to 10. So yesterday, after 10, NEPA didn't bring back the light. So we had to stay like that till today morning.
Okay, I understand.
Yes. Yes, sir. But it's only left only some 20 minutes. So I guess I'll finish this morning. But all I passed through, I understood very well. It's just for me to practice on accessing the HPC and try to work on those exercises. But okay. Everything is quite clear.
Okay, okay. Ms. Effiong, good morning. Is there any reason why people are arriving late this morning? Did it rain yesterday or something similar?
It didn't in Abuja. Sir, Hawa said she's having some technical issues, so she'll be a bit late.
Okay. Okay, okay.
Sorry, it was Hanato. Sorry, sir. Hanato.
Okay. Sorry, sir. Hanato. Yeah, unfortunately, when one is not on campus, there are always things. things that come up and stuff like that. Could be quite challenging participating in classes that way. But we'll make the best of what we can. So we're more or less supposed to be halfway. But what happens if we are not able to complete everything in the allocated time? Are we allowed to go extra? What are your thoughts?
We can try to go extra, but also depends on the situations we have. For instance, in my case, my battery can last for only 1 hour, and the gen, they normally power it off at 11. So after power off, I can go only for 1 hour. It means that after that 1 hour, I have to be offline and wait.
I understand, but I think maybe the question is more for Dr. Prasad. Maybe that rather than trying to finish everything in 3 weeks, we might go into a fourth week or something.
Maybe if we can discuss with him, probably we can do something from there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just a minute.
Okay, sir.
Okay. So are there any questions from the earlier classes we had this week? Wow, okay. Yeah, I think we are having some, okay. Yeah, so maybe without my video might be good for audio, especially for places where the network is bad. Okay, this is 1:15, so I guess we should start. So as requested yesterday, we're going to try and spend a few minutes trying to understand if there are questions from the previous classes and maybe try and answer them if we can. So I would like to invite you to present your questions if you have any. So I hope Miss Effion can hear us better now. Oh, she can hear me better. Feel free to type any questions you have in the chat area. Or just if you have a question from the previous lessons in the last 2 days, and feel free to bring them up. Okay, in the absence of any questions, we will start with the lessons for today. Okay. Okay, so today we'll be looking at the implementing scientific algorithms in parallel programming. The idea today is we will not do an exhaustive attempt at rewriting parallel algorithms in parallel, but we will simply focus on a few common ones just to give us a basic idea and a feel of how things happen. Okay. So the basic building blocks we employ when developing mathematical representations or when programming mathematical algorithms is things like iterative techniques. So you can have fixed size iterations where you use things like the for loops. And then you can also have the variable size iterations using the while loops. You could also have recursive programming and conditional statements. The basic principle is always divide and conquer. So our task is to split, or our goal is to split the program into as many smaller tasks as possible for independent execution. Or on the other hand, we could also focus on splitting the data into smaller blocks that can be processed independently. Okay, a very common operation that happens a lot is the addition of vectors. What you might not realize is that even somebody who's programming computer graphics, who's working with them, trying to build an image on a computer screen, either you are programming a game or something similar, but there's some interactive things happening, especially visually. It all amounts to working with vectors. So the basic representation of a vector addition is C is equal to A plus B. Okay. In this case, we can assume that A and B are two vectors, array vectors with 1,000 elements each. So it's just a very simple linear array. For the serial implementation, you will agree with me that the for loop we have here carries this out very well. So we go from, we have an index variable, which is I, and we vary the value of I from 0 to 1,000, okay? And then we increment the value of I by 1. So I is equal to I plus 1. So if you're familiar with programming for loops in C, you have the lower boundary specified by I is equal to 0. The upper boundary, I is less than 1,000. And I plus plus, the increment. So we increment I by 1. Okay, and then for this loop, we're going to simply solve the equation that CI is AI plus BI. Okay. Is it possible to do this using another technique such as recursion? What do you think? Do you understand what's meant by recursive programming? Any takes on recursive programming? Okay.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So I think there are programs that call themselves like repeatedly.
Okay, so programs, subroutines. Okay. I can write a subroutine that calls itself. That's a recursive program. Or a recursive subroutine.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any idea of how to do this using recursion?
So I'm unsure of that. I'm not familiar with that term before.
Okay. Okay. So in principle, we can make a very simple attempt at doing this. Let's see if we can. Okay, so let's define a function. Okay, let's say my vector add. Vector add, and we have. So the basic idea is that my main function will want to call vector okay, so we have, let's say, in A 1,000, B 1,000. So we are not going to bother ourselves with initializing them, but in principle we assume they have values already. So what we want to achieve is a situation where we call vector add, maybe with an index value. And vector add, so let's say int I is equal to 0, vector add I, okay? So int I. So all vector add has to do is to say CI is equal to AI plus BI. Are we familiar with this, or I mean, we're okay with this? Yeah. So the next thing will be to increment I. Okay. So I plus plus. Okay, and then we do a test. If I is less than 1,000, then we do vector add I. Otherwise, we return. So essentially, this is a recursive subroutine. So vector add is going to call itself as long as I is less than 1,000. Okay. And then as soon as it enters, the first thing it does is to carry out the addition we're expecting. And this means that it's expecting the variables. Sorry. So ideally, it should be something like this. We have to declare those variables as global. So they are declared as global, and in this case, it means they can be accessed by any of the subroutines. They are not private to any of the subroutines. So the main function just initializes your counter or your index and calls vector add with the first one, which is zero. So then we'll do C0 is equal to A0 plus B0. Then we increment I to 1. And as long as I is less than 1, we call vector add. Okay, so it recalls, it's going to recall itself. Okay. So we've seen a very basic implementation of this addition. Now, assuming we wanted to do this in parallel, are there any questions about the implementation, or we're okay? Assuming we wanted to carry out this computation in parallel, one idea will be to say, okay, we can use a number of threads to perform this addition. What do you think? And what's the optimal number of threads we shall need for this?
Are you asking for the basic equation or for the serial implementation?
Okay, we look, the serial implementation is actually shown on the slide. So you can see the serial implementation already on the slide here.
I meant like the optimal number of thread. Is it for like the optimal number of thread for the basic equation or the optimal number of thread for the serial implementation?
A serial implementation doesn't care about threads because everything happens serially. So one thread is all that will be ever used. Even if you create 20 threads, only one of them will do your work. So many times we don't speak about threads for serial implementation because the serial implementation always assumes one execution path. So we only have one thread ever occupied in a serial implementation. So I'm saying that looking at the discussions we had yesterday about doing things in parallel, how many threads would you recommend to carry out this addition of 1,000 elements?
Some, maybe four.
Four? Okay. And four is an interesting number. So why did you pick four? Do you understand the implications of four?
Okay, maybe I don't understand the parts that you're asking.
Okay, let's put it this way. I have 1,000 red buckets and 1,000 blue buckets. Yeah? And they both contain varying amounts of water. And then I have a yellow bucket and I want to pour the contents of the corresponding red and blue buckets into the yellow bucket. Okay. How do you think I can do this in parallel, or how many people do you think I will need to do this in parallel in an effective manner?
You will need two people, maybe one to hold the red, one to hold the other buckets, to pour it together.
Okay, but then these two people are going to have to cycle over 1,000 buckets, right? Because there's 1,000 red, 1,000 blue, and 1,000 yellow. So the real answer is really 1,000. If I have 1,000 people, or 1,000 persons, each one of them will simply pour the contents of one bucket, one red bucket and one blue bucket into the yellow bucket. And that's the end of the task. Do you get it? So each person only has to walk once and then the task is completed. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So in this case where we have 1,000 elements each, if we can create 1,000 threads, it means each thread will only have to do one operation and that's the end. Okay. So would you consider this to be data parallel or task parallel?
Can we say both?
I think it's task parallel.
Okay, so who goes for task parallel? That's Mary and Margaret. Yeah. And was it Blessing that said both? Okay, it's actually only task parallel. Data parallel means I'm carrying out the same operation on all my data. Okay, for example, let's say I have red buckets and I want to add 2 liters of water to the existing contents of this red bucket. That's data parallel. Okay, because I have the same operation happening on all my data. Okay. And then task parallel is really the fact that we are adding 2 different things, but each person may have different numbers. So I have 1,000 people, but their buckets are randomly filled. It's not the same amount. It's not the same amount you have in the red buckets. It's not the same amount you have in the blue buckets. So the contents of the yellow bucket are also going to be varying. They are not going to be equal. Okay, so each person has to go through this, the same motions of adding the contents of red and blue buckets into the yellow bucket, but the outcome is not the same. Do we get it?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So how do we, so assuming we are going to create 1,000 threads, ideally it would be very nice if we had a CPU that can handle 1,000 threads. Okay. But unfortunately, we don't have that. We are limited by the physical abilities of our CPU. So, how do we ensure? So if we're working with a hyper-threaded CPU, we know that it has one core and two threads. What can we do in this situation? And we still want to do things in parallel. So the final answer is really that the optimal number of threads is depends on what we have available in the system. Okay. Otherwise, we will fall into things like cache trashing. So if I have a CPU that has maybe one core and two threads, yeah? It means that if I create 1,000 threads, CPU will have to resort to context switching to give a time slice to each thread. So my optimal number for that CPU will be 2 threads. If I have a CPU that has 4 cores, okay, and each core has 2 threads, so that will be 8. Then my optimal number of threads will be 8 threads. So in any situation, yes, the ideal situation is that we should have 1,000 threads for working on this problem. But in any situation where we don't have 1,000 threads, if our processor doesn't have 1,000 threads or the ability to create 1,000 threads, then the optimal number is the number of threads we can create on that processor. Of course, you will understand that if we're using a processor or an accelerator where we can create thousands of threads, then we simply use 1,000. But if we're using a CPU, okay, where we have 8 threads or we have 16 threads, or 32 threads, then our optimal number of threads should be that which keeps the processor completely occupied. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay, if there are questions, if there are questions, then please feel free to ask them. Okay.
Sorry, sir.
Yes.
I didn't understand how we can manage multiple threads with the processor, which is having 2 cores and 2 threads. I didn't get the idea what you were explaining regarding this one.
Okay. So essentially, the answer to the question was, what is the optimal number of threads that should we use? Okay, we know that in the ideal situation, if I have 1,000 threads, each thread does only one operation, and then they've all finished, right? Now, if I try to create 1,000 threads on a machine that only supports 4 threads, so you said that there are two cores and each core has 2 threads, so that's a total of 4 threads, yeah, can be supported by that machine. If I try to create 1,000 threads on a machine that supports 4 threads, it means the CPU will have to use concurrency, context switching, to run each thread, to make sure that each thread gets some CPU time. And so what it's better in that situation is for me to divide my for loop. So instead of having one loop that goes from 0 to 1,000, I can have 4 loops. Each, the first one will go from 0 to 249. The second one will go from 250 to 499. The third one will go from 500 to 749. And the last one will go from 750 to 999. Okay, so what this means is that each thread gets to carry out 250 calculations. Okay, and then by the time each one has finished 250 calculations, they are all done. Do you understand it now?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Okay, so the next mathematical algorithm we shall look at is multiplication. So assuming we needed to multiply matrices together, okay? The standard equation is typically given by what you have here. C of I and J is the summation. It's going to do a summation of various items. A I k times B k j. Okay, where I is the number of rows in A, and J is the number of columns in B, and K is the number of columns in A. Your final matrix has dimensions of I and J, and it simply represents a cumulative addition of this. Do we know of any serial implementation for this? I have this. Okay, let me try and see if I can get us some code. Are we quite familiar with most of these operations? Oh, how good is our maths? Okay, let's stop 2016. application to stop sharing. Find document. Okay, I'm trying to look for a different, some lecture notes where I have this item. Okay, so this is more or less the code that implements multiplying two-dimensional matrices. So you have a matrix A with two dimensions, which is rows and columns. So I is the number of rows and K is the number of columns in your first matrix. And then you have B that has K number of rows and J number of columns. Okay, and C, the resulting matrix is going to have the summation of the, an iteration of the addition of, sorry, this multiplication. Okay, yes. So I think the sign here is wrong. It's supposed to be a multiplication symbol here. But this is a code that implements that. Okay. So we define a subroutine that returns a double, and then we say that A is double, B is double, and then we have number of rows in A, number of columns in A, and number of columns in B. And we create a new matrix C that has number of rows in A and number of columns in B. And then we simply have a loop. So we loop over the number of rows in A. Okay. And then inside this, we loop over the number of columns in B. And then the first thing we do is to initialize the value of the resulting MC. We initialize it to zero. And we then carry out a loop for carrying out the calculations. So we, for each of them, we go from K is equal to 1 to K is number of rows, we increment K, and then we simply add what we have here. So, yeah. It does seem to imply that there might be one row too much. Anyhow, it carries this out, and then it's going to return your matrix. Okay. So our task now is to say, okay, how can we do this in parallel? Is it as easy as the situation where we do a simple addition, where we saw that we can create four threads and then partition things out, and then have each thread do just a certain aspect of it? What do we think?
I'm not sure if we can do as we did in the previous example, but I look into it as if we can manage to divide the program so that they can run in parallel. Then at the end of it, they sum up the execution. But how are we going to do that? That is what I was thinking about. But I think it's possible to divide it so that it can be run into parallel and come up with the common solution.
Okay, thank you for the contribution. I believe that's Emmanuel. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Sir.
Yes. Go on.
I think to create it in parallel, we have to set so that each A, because each space of Cij, that's the new matrix we are forming, is going to be from, we know exactly where it's going to get the values from to multiply and add. So if there's a way we can have the various matrix points for the Cij, so that as the first, like C11 is being filled, C12 also be computed, C13 be computed, like that. So all the cells in the matrix will be computed at the same time.
Okay. The first question is this? I mean, so let's go back to the slides we were looking at yesterday. Step one, okay, whenever we have a problem, the first thing to do is to identify what we need to do. Are we going to carry out functional decomposition, or are we going to carry out domain decomposition? In other words, am I going to break it into smaller chunks of tasks, or am I going to be breaking my data into smaller chunks and then carry out the same operation on the data? So if we ask ourselves, what do we need to do here? What do you think we should do? We have this as a general equation. The I and j element of C is composed from a summation of the I and k element multiplied by the B, K, and J elements of the source matrices. Is it possible to do this with task decomposition as we break it up into tasks? So you understand that the main way of implementing this serially is to use loops. Yes, I need to use for loops. So I will have to vary a loop going from the minimum value of I to the maximum value of I. Okay. And then I'll need a second loop for the minimum value of J to the maximum value of J. Right? Hello, people.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
But then yes, sir. I have a third index. Do you notice that's K? So how many loops you think are needed to implement this?
I think you need 3 loops.
Three loops, sir.
Yes, you're quite right. Three loops. And that's what we had in this document. So you can see there's one loop here. This loop only focuses on I. And then this is a second loop. You can see it encloses the second loop. The second loop here focuses on J. Okay, and the third loop focuses on K. So we need three loops to implement this. Okay. So minimally, I think every programmer should be able to write something down in whatever language you are familiar with once you have an idea of how many loops are involved. Does that make sense? Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay. It's also possible to write this using recursion. It's left as a, this is the same subroutine, but using the recursive technique. So you find that there's just a subroutine that calls itself. Okay, so the first thing it does, it doesn't use that many loops, but it only keeps one, the innermost loop. Okay, and it assumes that it's been passed the maximum values. So what it does is to decrement. So it's reducing the value of J. Okay. But it's actually reducing it when it's doing the passing here. Okay, and then reducing the number of I as well. And then it makes just one loop calculation, then calls itself to perform the second calculation until it finishes.
Sorry, can I hear you?
You can't hear me? Okay, essentially, I'm saying that first thing to do is to identify number of loops. And in this case, we have three loops. So we can always write an iterative code that works in three loops. It's possible to also write a recursive solution where I have a subroutine that calls itself rather than using three loops. Okay. That's also a possibility. So in the ideal situation, how many threads will I need to carry out this operation? In the ideal situation, okay, so let's say very simply, we focus on this. We don't bother ourselves with the recursive implementation of this, which is an interesting exercise. But very simply, I can parallelize this using exactly the same idea I had last time, which is I can focus on parallelizing this outer loop. Okay.
Yes, sir.
So what this implies is that in the ideal situation, the number of threads I need should be always equal to the number of items I have in the outermost loop. It's a very simplified view of it. Okay. Does that make sense?
Okay, sir. Yes, sir. So, for instance, for this example which we have, it means that we are supposed to have two threads.
So if you want
sir,
to
please,
carry
can
this
can you
out,
explain it again?
Okay, so I can implement this as serial code using three loops. Okay. And okay, so these are, or this is a serial code that implements that particular equation, that particular mathematical expression. Okay, and we have three loops on I, on J, and on K. Okay, so very easiest parallelization technique is not the, I mean, I say an ideal situation, is that I will create this number of workers or this number of threads, okay, number of rows in A, which is the I. That's the I here. Okay, and simply have each thread work on a single row. Okay, it's a decent parallelization strategy. It's not bad. Okay, and then each thread will then have to carry out the loop internally to do this. Yeah, and then each of this loop also has to perform another loop to do this.
Okay.
It's okay, it works. There's no problem with that. Okay, but ideally, if I wanted to make everything completely parallel, it means I will need to have a set of parallel threads here, another set of parallel threads here, and possibly another set of parallel threads here. Paying attention to dependencies, because some variables should not change until another variable has been changed. Okay, so when we write parallel code, one of the easiest strategies for if you have an existing serial code and you want to make it parallel, one of the easiest strategy, and you gain a lot of speed this way, is to focus on changing your loops to threads, trying to find a way in which you can remove the loops and replace them with an equivalent number of threads or as high enough threads as possible to carry out the work. We saw that this was very easy here because here we had only a single loop and in an ideal situation, 1,000 threads, and each thread simply carries out one calculation and that's the end. In this situation, we have three nested loops. So there's a loop inside another loop inside another loop. So for simplicity, the easiest thing to do is to say, okay, I can focus on parallelizing the outer loop. And if I do that successfully, I should get a boost in performance. That's fine. That's going to work and you will get the boost in performance. Okay. Is everybody happy with that?
Yes, I'm okay.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay. Okay. What I'm just pointing out is just for information. But since I have other loops, I can also apply the same technique to those inner loops. Yeah. And so if I can successfully replace all the loops by thread, then I should have a very, very optimal or ideal and parallel program where everything can be done in parallel. But for this situation, this particular equation, it is not that easy. Okay.
Okay, sir.
Does anybody know why?
I think it's because the loops here depends. For instance, the outer the innermost loop depend on the next outer loop, and then that outer loop depends on the outermost loop. So because of dependence, I think that might be excellent to do because of that dependence.
Okay. Yes, there are dependencies. That's the right answer. There's data dependencies. What do we mean by that? Dependencies in the data. Okay. So you understand that I cannot calculate. I mean, the value of I and J, I mean, the value of C is a cumulative addition of the multiplications of these elements. So we are going to loop over A and B and multiply row colon with colon row, something like that, okay? So we have a dependency here. You notice that J here depends on, I mean, so this inner loop depends on the values that have been set for J and values that have been set for I by the outer loops. Okay. So even if I'm going to try and parallelize this, it changes based on what we're doing out here. So it's not impossible, but it's a bit more difficult to do. So for simplicity's sake, we will focus on saying, okay, we parallelize just this outer one, and then we'll go. Maybe we can explore a much more interesting solution later. Okay. So this also suggests that, yes, please ask a question.
Can I go back to your previous slide? I want to ask something.
Here we are.
Okay. So yes, you said the reason why this is going to be hard to implement because of dependency. Yesterday, when we talked about threads and having another thread, calling another thread before starting an operation, can that also be one of the reasons why it would be hard to implement that three loops?
So this slide is quite easy to do because this one is the addition. So we're looking at the multiplication now, which is, so we have three loops, one inside the other.
No, not this one, the one with three loops.
You mean this one?
Yes, this is one I'm referring to, yes.
Okay, so this is more or less the serial implementation for what I'm showing in the slide. So this is, that's just the serial code for implementing this, okay? So, we can, in principle, create threads based on this outer loop as the first four. Does that make sense? That works very well. Yeah? So the question was, okay, if I can create threads for this, can I also create threads for this one and create threads for this one? Okay. So the answer is the threads that are going to do this one depend on the outer loop here.
Yeah.
Okay. And this inner loop also depends on this thread here. I mean, the value that is coming from this loop and the value that is coming from this loop. So I will have to pay close attention to that. Otherwise, I will end up getting wrong values. If I say, okay, this guy create threads to calculate this one, and this this here we create another set of threads to do each of this independently. Okay. So the key concept is just pay attention when you have nested loops. If you are thinking of parallelizing nested loops, pay attention and just do what you are safe with. And safest is to say, okay, we focus on replacing this outer loop with a set of threads. You will already get a good boost in performance. Okay. And then as you become more comfortable with doing things in parallel and thinking in parallel, you then can sit down and think how we can replace these loops with threads for working in parallel. Is that clear?
Yes, it is. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So I think a good programmer can also write, implement this using the recursive technique. So have a subroutine that calls itself. Many times, if you are trying to parallelize some code and they use recursive techniques, it's much more difficult to come up with a parallel version. Okay. With an efficient parallel version compared to recursive code. For example, this is my iterative version. Iterative because it uses for loops. So I'm iterating over a set of values, 3 for loops, and I'm done. Okay. On the other hand, I can use a recursive version. So this is a recursive version. So we have only one loop in this recursive version, but it calls itself. Okay. Now, assuming I'm going to try and parallelize this piece of code here, and I focus on replacing this for loop with threads. Is that easy, right? Yeah, there's only one loop. We focus with replacing it by threads, and we are done. You agree with me? We will quickly discover that there's a problem because we create threads here and we destroy them immediately. Okay, we create threads and we finish with the threads immediately. And then we go into the routine again and create new threads again and destroy them immediately. Go into the routine again, create new threads and destroy them immediately. So it's not efficient, and we might instead see a drop in performance simply by trying to parallelize this loop because of the fact that a recursion is happening. So the recursion is this aspect here, the fact that we are calling ourselves again. Okay. And so sometimes if you find that a piece of code was written using recursion, in order to parallelize it efficiently, you may have to try and switch it back to an iterative version. Sorry, somebody wanted to say something. Okay, so that's why it says iterative code is always easier to work with and understand, especially if you are trying to think in parallel, than the recursive version. Okay. So there's a question here. Is there going to be somebody has a question?
No, sir.
Okay, is there going to be issues with respect to cache trashing? So assuming I say, okay, we focus on parallelizing the outer loop. Okay, so we have a processor that has four threads. So we simply divide the outer loop into four equal parts and then have each part only do a part of the calculation. What's going to happen with respect to my cache? The data that one thread needs is not the same data because each thread is going to be working on a different range. So the data that one thread needs is not the same data that the other thread will need. Is there something I can do here to help?
Yes.
Okay, good. So what can I do to help? Oh, that yes wasn't for me. Okay. Essentially, I can try to alleviate any cache trashing by rearranging my data in the same way dividing or parallelizing my code. So we have two matrices. Right, two matrices, number of rows. Let me see, maybe I can try and share something. Stop sharing. Yeah, let me try and get something to. Are you with me? I have two matrices. So we have A11, A12, A13, A21, A22, A. And we're thinking of multiplying them with another matrix, B11, B12. Okay, and this is a multiplication. Okay, are we comfortable with this sketch? Okay, so the key concept is what's going to happen when I try to parallelize this. Let's say we want to parallelize based on three. Okay, so we'll have threads T1 should work on row one. So it should only focus on A1X. Okay. Thread T2 should focus on row two, and thread T3 should focus on A3X. Yeah, so quite simple, right? Does that make sense? Okay, so in order to avoid cache trashing, I should, in principle, try and feed my data in such a way that when the threads are looking for their data, they find them. Okay. So if I try to present my data as follows, say, okay, I'm going to send my data to the processor, as load it into the processor in the normal way. So I will load this row, and load this row, then load this row, then load this row, and this row. You will find that while thread one has data to work immediately, thread two will have to remove data from the cache to get at what it should do. And thread three will have to wait for thread one and two to finish with their data before it gets its data, if we are loading this way. So the ideal situation will be, okay, to try and load my data into the CPU, to try and load my data into the CPU such that I give in, okay, I try and load my data into the CPU, something like this, A11, A21, A31. Okay, so this means, it has a mind of its own. Thread T3 doesn't have to wait for A1 to complete before it finds its data. So in order to improve the efficiency of this kind of algorithm, I would in principle also need to adjust how I load the values of my matrices into the system or into the processor. So I may say, okay, we feed A11, A21, A31, then you feed B11, B12, B13. And then you feed in A21, A22, A23, or B21. Okay. Does that make sense? So I don't load all of A at once. I only load the portions that I need to carry out the immediate calculation. So that's a bit of okay, so in order to help, so that's the answer to this part of the problem. I can perform some data rearrangement, okay? And that will sort of help with cache trashing. Okay, I don't know if there are any questions or any comments or... Oh, we can go on.
I think we can go on.
Okay. So, are we familiar with multiplying matrices?
Yes, sir.
Yes. And
you know that the same consideration applies if you are multiplying a matrix with a vector. Just that you are missing a second, are missing this part here. You just have BK, you don't have J. Okay. But the idea is more or less the same thing. You will still need three loops and it works in the same manner. Okay, yep. So what if we wanted to do factorials? Do you remember factorials?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the factorial is typically written by this equation. For n is greater than or equal to 0, you have n factorial is equal to 1 if n is 0, and n times n minus 1 factorial otherwise. So you can see that the algorithm by itself includes factorial in its definition. So this already suggests that it's a very easy algorithm to implement recursively. And if we look at the iterative version, I don't know if that's clear on your screen. The iterative version is what we have below here. But it's as simple as creating a subroutine or a function factorial. We pass it n, and then you initialize I and factorial, and you set factorial is equal to 1. And for you start a loop for I going from n to I is greater than 2, you subtract n and you simply multiply by I and you return itself. Oh, sorry. This is iterative. Recursive is very easy. Yeah, I was a bit confused here. So the recursive is really here, factorial. We take the factorial. If n is 0, return 1. Otherwise, return n times factorial of n minus 1. Simple. And you're done. And that's the factorial algorithm as a recursive subroutine. If we are going to write it in an iterative manner, it becomes a bit more involving because we have to start from n and we sort of count back towards 0 or towards 1. We don't need to multiply by 1 because anything multiplied by 1 is already itself. So that's why we stop at 2. We subtract and then we make the calculation. And then eventually we return the factorial. So this definition by itself suggests that it's simple and straightforward to implement this way. Okay. Using a simple if-else statement, and we are done. But iteratively, it's a bit more difficult to understand. Are we clear? Are we okay with this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I know it can be quite tough combining mathematics and programming, but many times you'll discover that the beauty of programming is really when you're able to transfer mathematical expressions like this into some code that can give you results very fast and without much difficulty. Okay, so what shall we do here if we are going to create a parallel version of this code? Any suggestions?
So I will make the for loop thread.
Okay, so we can use a for loop and try and, what do we do if we're using a for loop? Please explain some more.
So if we can break it into chunks, but I think this one may be data decomposition. Then from there, we can now use thread.
Okay, so we can break it into chunks. Okay. Why do you feel it's data decomposition?
Because it's using the value of the one behind it. It's dependent.
Okay, it's dependent, but it's not data decomposition. Data decomposition implies that I'm going to multiply every item with the same value, or I'm going to multiply every item or add the same number to every item.
Okay.
So this one is still task because we have to carry out multiplications. And if we divide our loop, so for example, let's say we are trying to find the factorial of a number like 20, and we want to use 4 threads. We can simply have one thread carry out the multiplication of 1 to 5. And then the next thread will carry out the multiplication of 6 to 10. The third thread will do 11 to 15, right? And then the last thread will do 16 to 20. Okay. And then we now have to collect all their independent results together and carry out a final multiplication. Does that make sense? So the results from thread 1 times the results from thread 2 times the results from thread 3 times the results from thread 3 will give us the final answer. Okay, let me try and... So let's say thread 1. Thread 1 should calculate 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5. Thread 2 should calculate 6 times 7 times 8 times 8 times 9 times 10. Thread 3 should calculate 11 times 12 times 13 times 14 times 15. Thread 4 will calculate 16 times 17 times 18 times 19 times 20. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Okay.
But then yes, my final answer is, the answer is going to be T1 times T2 times T3 times T4. So task was to calculate 20 factorial using 4 threads. Calculate the factorial of 20 using 4 threads. So simply by decomposing it, I can break the task to be done into 4 different chunks. So task 1 will carry out this multiplication, task 2 will carry out this multiplication, task 3 will do this, and task 4 will do this. And then my answer, the answer to the question, still needs to have a multiplication step being done where I carry out this multiplication and then I can give the result. Okay, does that make sense? Do we agree?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Is it confusing? Is it confusing?
A bit confusing, but we're trying our best to understand.
Do you have any questions? So we have, so okay, so let's probably just go right again. So our task is to parallelize factorial, okay? The algorithm is represented by this mathematical expression. Are we comfortable with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The mathematical expression itself uses factorial. So it says that if n is equal to 0, the answer will be 1. If n is not equal to 0, which is what we have here, otherwise, n should be n times n minus 1 factorial. So we have to multiply n by n minus 1 factorial. So when, what is the factorial of 0 is 1. Factorial of 1 is going to be 1, because we will have 1 times 0 factorial, which is 1, which will be 1. What of 2 factorial will be 2 times 1 factorial, which is 1, which will give us the value of 2, right? 3 factorial will be 3 times 2 factorial. So if I'm coding this algorithm serially, because of the fact that it includes itself, I can do that simply using a recursive approach. So I create a subroutine called factorial that accepts n. Okay, and if n is equal to 0, we return 1 immediately. Otherwise, we return n multiplied by the factorial of n minus 1. So when n minus 1 starts the factorial, it will also decrease n minus 1. So it will sort of recursively get all the way down to a situation where n is 0. Okay, and which returns 1, and then everything will back out and I will have my calculation being done. Is that clear? Okay, it's not very easy to parallelize this. Anything that depends on the recursive approach is not that easy to create a parallel version. Okay, think of it this way. If I'm thinking of doing this way, it means I will have to create separate subroutines for each thread. So assuming we're trying to do the calculation of 5 factorial, it means if I'm going to use recursions, I should create 5 different subroutines and each one returns the factorial of a particular number. Okay, that's not efficient to do. What I can do instead is to say, okay, can I rewrite this in an iterative manner? Yes, I can. And by doing that, I introduce a for loop. So this for loop says we can start at the highest number, n, and keep counting down. As we are counting down, we are multiplying the values of I with the existing contents of factorial. We are multiplying down with the existing contents of factorial. Just give me a minute. Let me see if I can. Okay. Yes. So we are multiplying down using the existing values of n. And we are going from the largest value to the smallest value. So you can see that the loop here starts from n and it counts down to 2. And it's subtracting I minus minus is subtraction. But what does it do? It multiplies the existing contents of the variable factorial with the value of I. And when it has finished the loop, it returns the contents of factorial as the final value. why do we stop at 2? Are there any takes on why we stop at 2? Let me see if you understand it. Why do we stop at 2? Okay, let's come back to this expression. If you look at this expression, this is the same as 2 × 3 × 4 × 5. Do you agree? Reason is that anything multiplied by 1 is going to be the same value. And of course, we know that 0 factorial is always 1. So we can, in principle, simply go up to 2. So in a sense, if you carry out this multiplication, 6 times 4, 24 times 5. Will that be 120? Do you agree with that? Or am I wrong?
Yes, it's okay.
Okay, have we lost anybody? Okay, so anyhow, this is the same thing as 1 times 120. So when programming, computers are not very sharp. Okay, so if I end this at 1, it is still going to make that extra recursion. But my value doesn't change. It's just an additional waste of CPU cycles. So by ending at 2, I save myself a few CPU cycles. Okay, especially for something like factorial. So how do I make this parallel? I can say, okay, I can divide, assuming n is equal to 20, can I divide it into 4 portions? Because I have 4 threads. I'm working on a machine with 2 processors and each processor, or each 2 cores, and each core has 2 threads. So I can say, okay, let me divide my loop into 4 parts, and then have each thread just do a section of it. And this is what we see here. T1 is thread 1, T2 is thread 2, T3 is thread 3, and T4 is thread 4. So thread 1 does 5 factorial, and thread 2 does 6 times 7 times 8 times 9 times 10. This is not the same thing as 10 factorial. Okay. Thread 3 does the multiplication of 11 to 15, which is not the same as 15 factorial. Thread 4 does this, okay? And so I'll get out separate values here, but they are all part of the final solution. So my final answer is really equal to the output of T2 multiplied by the output of T1 multiplied by the output of T3. And T4. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So this is 3024, and this one is Okay. And so my final answer is going to be 120 times 3024 times 360. And what do I get? Okay, we get a very large number. Okay. So, if you probably try to perform, let's see if we can get a calculator and verify that. 20 factorial. Yep. So you can see that a calculator reported that the 20 factorial is going to be 2432902008, which is more or less the same as this. Okay. Okay, does that make sense now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, essentially, what we've implemented, you will see, is one of these two. So we separated out the task. Okay, we separated out the task, and each of the four threads did something different. So they each got different values for their loops. So assuming they were all going to use loops to implement this, they only had to loop over four or five different items. So this one went from 1 to 5. This one went from 6 to 10. This one went from 11 to 15, and this one from 16 to 20. Okay, those were the values they were given. And then when they finished their calculation, we needed to collect all their outputs, which is the final results they each got, which was 120, 3024, and so on and so forth. But the operation we did in the reduction is multiplication. So we simply collected all their final values and multiplied, and we got a final answer. Okay, it's not considered a gather operation because we are not collecting back memory locations. We are simply collecting outputs, performing an operation on these outputs, and then providing the results. Interestingly enough, what happens if one thread finishes faster than another thread? What do you think? We need to perform a synchronization. We have to wait for the results from all threads before we can produce the final answer. So assuming I'm going to write the code this way. So this is running on its own. So this in a sense represents one thread, yeah? And this is one worker thread, second worker thread, third worker thread, fourth worker thread. All five of them are running. But the final answer has to wait for the outputs from these threads before we can do the final calculation. So I must place a barrier in this thread saying, wait for these guys to send you their results. When you've collected all their results, then proceed to make a final calculation and give the results to the, give the final results to the end user. Okay. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's look at another routine. The GCD. What do you understand by GCD?
Greatest common divisor.
Okay, so greatest common divisor, it means we are finding the largest value that can divide a pair of numbers. Okay. So the equation is valid for m is greater than n and n is greater than zero. And your GCD of m and n is going to be equal to n if n can divide m without any remainder. So m divided by n or m modulus n is going to give us zero. Otherwise, it's another GCD operation of n and with the remainder that comes out of this modulus operation. So what does this tell us again? It's an algorithm that that calls itself. I don't know. I guess probably what we need to understand is that there's a strong relationship between mathematics and programming. Okay, a lot of the things you do in programming and on computers have a mathematical basis. Okay, and so if you can write out, whenever you have a challenge to transfer an equation to a computer program, if you can write out the algorithm of that mathematical expression, you're already very close to understanding how you can implement that algorithm easily. So in this case, we can see here that GCD is an algorithm that can also involve itself. So this means that I can implement it easily using a recursive solution. Okay, is it possible to get an iterative solution? Let me see. Okay, so the recursive solution is very easy, and it's sometimes called the Euclid's algorithm. It simply says that if the modulus of m and n is equal to zero, we can return n. Otherwise, we return the GCD of n and the remainder of m and n. Okay? And that's the Euclid's algorithm. Okay, it's a bit more complicated when we have to do it iteratively. So here we say that we have M and N, we set Y to be equal to N. We divide N by Y, multiply by Y. If it's not equal to N, and M divided by Y is not equal to M, and y is greater than 1, then we should always divide y by n. Otherwise, we return y. Okay, so essentially what this is doing is simply saying we start at n and we reduce the value of n, or we can reduce the value of n by 1 for each, and then we try to divide both n and m by this new number. And if that new number successfully divides both of them without any remainder, then we know that's okay. Otherwise, we reduce it by 1 and continue doing that. Okay. Does that make sense? Hello, people?
No, sir. I don't get it.
Okay, so, yes. Okay, so what's going to happen with this? So there are actually 4 different serial implementations here, or 5. Okay, what's going to happen is I have 2 numbers. So let's try and go back to this scratch document. I have 2 numbers, let's say 10 and 5. Find the GCD of 10 and 5. What's your answer? Hello, somebody, what's your answer? Emmanuel. Can anyone provide an answer to this? The GCD of 10 and 5. Okay, so the answer is equal to 5. Why? Because 5 can divide itself without a remainder, and 5 can divide 10. Without a remainder. So 10 divided by 5 is 2. There's no, it's not a
Sorry,
fraction.
I had an issue with this mute button. I couldn't unmute.
Okay. Anyhow, 5, you agree that 5 is the answer, right? So let's try a different one. Find the GCD of 10 and 4. Okay. Do you have an answer for this?
Is 2, sir.
Okay, answer is equal to 2. Good. So how can a computer determine this? That's the challenge. We want to write a piece of code that allows the computer to determine that the value of this should be 2. Okay, so one thing I can do is to say, okay, I take the value of 10 and I divide it by the second number. I take the first number and divide by the second number. 10 divided by 4 is going to give us 2 remainder 2, right?
Yes, sir.
Do you agree? Or let me write with small r. 2 remainder 2. So, or this is going to be equal to 2.5, right? So as long as it's not a whole number, then I know that that's not a divisor. So 4 can divide 4, but it's not a divisor of 10. So what else can I do? I can say, okay, let's try 3. I subtract 1 from 4. Okay, and say 4 divided by 3 is going to be 1.333 or 1 remainder 1. Mm-hmm. And 10 divided by 3 is going to be equal to 3 remainder 1. So it doesn't work. 3 doesn't work. Then I can subtract, why did this stupid thing appear? I can subtract another digit, or I can subtract 1 again from 3. Okay. So if I subtract 1 from 3, I get 2. 4 divided by 2 will be equal to 2 remainder 0. And 10 divided by 2 will be equal to 5 remainder 0. Hey, no remainders. So 2 is a valid value. Answer is equal to 2. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So if I'm going to transfer that to code, I can say something like for I is equal to 4, comma, I is equal to 1, or I is equal to 2, I minus minus. Okay, and I open a block and say, if M divided by I or let's say if M modulus I
yes
is equal to 0 and N modulus I is equal to 0. This is the answer, right? Answer is equal to I. Right? So yes. Instead of this, I simply put N here. So more or less, this is a piece of code that will determine the GCD and set it to be the value of ANS. Although in principle, I have to sort of also add this. Let's say ANS is equal to 0. If ANS is greater than 0, break. Does it make sense now? Are we together?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so this is a very simple for loop that says I can calculate the GCD by starting from N and then going all the way to 2. If the modulus so we start from N. If M modulus N is equal to 0 and N modulus N is equal to 0, the answer will be N. And because N has been set greater than 0, we break. Break means we jump out of this loop. We no longer perform the other iterations of the loop, even if they are present. Simply go out. And we can print F.
But, sorry, sir.
Yes, go on. I'm listening.
Yeah, I don't see the existence of M. I saw it.
You don't see the existence of M? Hello? Okay, so let's say int GCD int m, int n. Looks like we've lost him. Emmanuel, are you still with us? Okay, is anybody having issues or we can go on? So this is a very simple serial implementation of the GCD. If the modulus of I is zero and modulus of I with M and modulus of N with M. So I call it saying GCD and I pass it two values, 10 and 4. So it's going to go from 4 and check if 10 is divisible by 4 with a remainder of zero. And 4 is divisible by 4 with a remainder of 0. If not, answer is still 0. So we loop back here where we have this condition that says we subtract. So next time is going to be 3. It does 3 and loops back again. And then it does 2 and checks. Yeah, this should be greater than or equal to. Okay. Okay, are we okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do we all agree with this implementation, this function?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so is it also possible to implement this using a recursive solution as to write a subroutine that calls itself? Yes, it's very easy because the algorithm itself includes that. So you can see the algorithm says n. If for all other values, we should simply use n and the remainder. Okay. Okay, so we won't really dwell on that. So the challenge is, assuming I wanted to parallelize this, what can I do? Does anybody have a suggestion? Can I break this down for as work for threads? What do we think? Can I break it down as work for threads? Or how can I implement or replace this for statement? How can I replace this for loop with threads? What do we think?
So I think you can break it down.
Okay. So explain, how can I do that? Sometimes it's good to sort of use an example. So let's say we're using 10 and 4. I wanted to break this into so we are supposed to sort of create four separate chunks, where so we'll have T1, we'll have a for loop of 4, I is equal to 4, comma I is greater than or equal to 4. I minus minus, okay, and then T2 will use loop parameters of what do you think? 3, 3, yeah, and then T3 will use and T4 will use so for the example where we're using 4, this is what comes out. But okay, let's say instead of 4, let's say we want to use, okay, so let's create a different question. Find the GCD of 10 and 8. So in this case, we know that our first loop is going to be 8, and this should probably be 7. This will be 6, 4, 2, 5, 3, 1. Okay. Is this what you had in mind?
Mostan, the confusion here is it that the loop is going to take even the if statement, like each loop will have the if statement combined?
The answer is yes, but there is a bigger problem. There is a much bigger problem. Well, okay, it's not so much of a bigger problem. Okay, so essentially in thread one, what we want is thread one should implement this block. The rest of the code like this remains exactly the same. Okay. So thread one will implement this block, right? Thread two will implement this block. Thread 3 will implement this block. Thread 4 will implement this block. Does that make sense? Do you agree?
Sir, please, can you explain further why you broke it down to those steps by 8, 7, 6, 5.
Okay, so I have 8 here, and I want to use 4 threads. What should I have? What is 8 divided by 4?
It's 2.
So that means each thread should only work on 2 iterations or 2 items, right? So okay. Thread 1 is going to work on 8 and 7. Thread 2 will work on 6 and 5. Thread 3 will work on 4 and 3. And last thread will work on 2 and 1. Okay?
Yes, sir.
So let's make it a bit more interesting. So let's say we are taking 20 and 12. And I have 4 threads. How many iterations will I have per thread?
So I need to be question. Is it 20 and 12? Oh, okay. That'll be 3 iterations per thread.
Okay, so for 3 iterations per thread, what should be here? What should be my loop values? So this will be 12. Does that make sense? So the starting point for each thread will be the first thread starts from the value here. And then once I determine the gap, so between 12 and 3, that's 4. My next thread has to start from after leaving that gap. Okay, so 9, because 12 divided by 4 is 3. 12 minus 3 is going to be 9. And then to find where the next thread should start from again, I subtract 3 from 9, which will be 6. And then to get the last one, I subtract 3 from 6, which will be 3. Okay. Do you understand it now?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what's the issue here? What else do we need? I will need to obtain the results from each of the threads.
I'll add all the results.
You can't add all the results.
I think
you can't add all the results. You have to take the maximum of all the results. Addition doesn't work. Why doesn't addition work? Let's examine them carefully. Okay. So we have 12 and 20. Here, we are going to get an answer of 0 because 12 doesn't work, 11 doesn't work, 10 doesn't work. So the first thread is going to give us 0. The second thread is going to give us what? So 9 doesn't work, 8 doesn't work, 7 doesn't work. So the second thread will give us 0. The third thread is going from 6 to 4. Does 6 work? No. Does 5 work? No. Does 4 work? Yes. 4 works. So thread 3 will give us 4. Thread 4 is doing from 3 to 1. It tries 3. 3 doesn't work. 2. Does 2 work? Yes. 2 works. So thread 4 is going to give us an answer of 2. Okay, so T4 will give us 0. Oh, sorry, T1. T1 will give 0. T2 will give 0. T3 will give 4. T4 will give 2. So if we add the results together, what do we get? T1 plus T2 plus T3 plus T4 is equal to 6, which is wrong, right? Correct answer is max of T1, T2, T3, T4. So we have to pick the maximum value. Whichever one returns the maximum value, that's the answer. Does that make sense? So our reduction operation is going to be identifying the maximum. So your reduction is not always constant. Sometimes you have to understand when you need to add, when you need to subtract, when you need to multiply, when you need to divide, when you need to calculate the maximum, when you need to calculate the minimum. So if we are doing the LCM or LCD, right? This function will be mean, not max. So we get the minimum value of all of them from all the threads, and that's our answer. Okay, is anyone following me or do you have?
Sir, please, for the T4, how do we get to?
Come again?
For the T4, how did you get to?
So, okay, this is the question. The question says, find the GCD of 20 and 12 using four threads. So we simply, the numbers, M is equal to 20 and N is equal to 12. So for T4, M is 20. 20 divided by 2 will give you 10, no remainder. 12 divided by 2 will give you 6, no remainder, right?
Yes.
For T4, yeah, this one. Yes. So it iterates and tries 3. 3 doesn't work because 3 can divide 12 without a remainder, but it cannot divide 20. 20 will produce a remainder. Okay. But when it comes to 2, it finds that 20 divided by 2, there's no remainder. 12 divided by 2, there's no remainder. You guys didn't notify me about this.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You know, one of the beauties of mathematics is when you can solve it, then you can hardly go wrong. If the maths checks out, then you are okay. Yeah? Okay, so this is what we have, T004. And if we do an add, so add operation, you will get 6. If you do a multiplication, you will get 0, which is also wrong. If you do a division, you will have probably some problems because of the divide by 0. So it's a maximum. So once we get max, this works for LCD. I mean for GCD. Now, what if we had to do LCD? You know what LCD is? Not liquid crystal display, of course. in maths.
Least common division.
Yeah. So, assuming we had exactly the same question, but we're to calculate LCD, what should we do?
Use less than.
Okay. So, our final answer.
Instead of maths.
Yes, our final answer should be calculated using mean. And in this case, that will be 2. Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I'm happy we are agreeing on that. Okay, what of integrations? Have you ever heard about the fact that you can integrate numerically? Hello, people.
So, yes, sir.
Did you ever hear of the fact that you can carry out integrations numerically? Mathematical integrals. Okay, anyhow, the idea is very easy to understand if we consider the above equation. So in this equation, we can see that the integral of 1 over 1 plus x squared varied over x, okay, is going to give us arctan of x from 0 to 1. Okay, and typically we know that this is the same as pi divided by 4. This expression, when you go from 0 to 1. If you go instant value of 1 to instant value of 0, it's going to give you pi divided by 4. So to calculate the value of pi, we can simply multiply this integral by 4. So we have 4 with an integral going from 0 to 1, calculating 1 over 1 plus x squared. Okay, with variations over x. What is actually an integral? What do you understand by an integral? Graphically, when I draw a curve, when I draw a curve, what's an integral?
Like a change in from one point to the other, change in y, change in x from one point to the other.
I think the change is the differential, isn't it? Is it? Yeah.
Integral is the area.
Yes, integral is the area under the curve. So assuming we have this curve here, you can see a curve here. The integral of this curve is really calculating the area we have here. So the area bounded by the curve. So in other words, assuming I wanted to calculate this area, I wanted to calculate the integral of this curve. I can simply calculate the area occupied by this section. And that's my integral. Of course, you will notice that the limits of the integral, 0, here, 1 here, okay, and that's the curve. So the integral will be given by the contents of this area under the curve. Okay, it's not as simple as doing height times width, which will give us the area of a rectangle. and there are already formulas for calculating the area of a triangle, right? Are we following?
Yes, sir.
Yes,
the
sir.
The area of this triangle, of this rectangle here, will be 1, that's 0 to 1, 1 times 4, which is this height here. Okay. If I wanted to calculate the area of a triangle, what's the area of a triangle?
Half base times height.
Good, half base times height. Okay. And so essentially, what I can do is to say, okay, can I calculate the area provided by segments? I can calculate the area in segments. So if you look at this segment here, is the area of a full rectangle minus the area of this small angle, triangle here. Yeah? Does that make sense? Similarly, the area
of
this segment, the area of this triangle minus the area of this small rectangle. And then the area under this is area of this segment is this one minus the area of this. Yeah. And then similarly, we have here as well the rectangle subtracting the area of this. Rectangle subtracting the area of this. But you will notice another thing. There's this portion here, and there's this portion here that's under the curve. So in each of them, even as I subtract this, I will need to sort of calculate and add this. The same as when I subtract this, I will need to calculate and add this. Subtract this, I'll need to calculate and add this. Subtract this, I'll need to calculate and add this. Subtract this, this one, but I will need to calculate and add this one. Okay, so the thinner my slices are, the less. So if I have a slice that is very, very close together, so assuming I have a slice that goes like this, so you'll discover that I have area of a rectangle plus area of a small triangle. Whereas for the next portion, I'm having area of a rectangle minus a portion of a rectangle. So simply by calculating this area, I mean areas that I know already, I know how to calculate the areas of a triangle, I know how to calculate the areas of a rectangle. By using these calculations, I can come up with an approximate value for what the integral should be. In other words, a computer program can simply iterate over each segment here, calculating the area of the triangles and the rectangles enclosed by that area, and using that to using the final summation to subsequently come up with the total area that is under the triangle. Does it make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Are you guys interested in looking at some maths, or we can sort of call it a day?
I think we can call it a day so that we can go and digest this which you taught us today.
We
have to revise we have to revise these mathematical calculations and try to take into consideration how we can just divide these equations so as to be able to work in parallel, like make them work in different threads and come up with one solution.
Okay, so basically we will probably maybe stop here. We won't try to look at the mathematical aspects of implementing the integration. But so when you ask a program like MATLAB to carry out an integration, this is exactly what it does. Okay, it just tries to calculate the area under a curve. So if I can look at from this value to this value, what are the values at each point for my curve, and then calculate areas, equivalent areas for those ones, and then sum all of this together, I should get out a reasonably accurate value for what I have here. The important thing to understand, especially with this calculation of integrals, is that the smaller my segments are, the more accurate my value is. Okay? So accuracy is inversely proportional to the width of these segments. If my width becomes so small that I don't have to subtract anything, I can just get away with calculating the area of rectangles and adding them all up together, and I have a reasonably accurate result. So where does the for loop come in? Because I have to have segments. So segments of fixed width. So if I use a width of, let's say, 100. Okay, so if I divide this thing into 100 segments, my accuracy is one value, but I'll get a result, a very fast result. If I use 100,000, I will get better accuracy. If I use 1 million, I'll get much better accuracy. If I use 100 million, I'll get much more accuracy, a much more accurate result. So the challenge for doing it in parallel is to say, okay, I want to do 100 million iterations, okay, and do it in such a way that I don't have the user having to wait for the calculations to come out, for the results to come out. But that's basically the concept. Okay?
Okay, sir.
Okay, so we will probably close the chapter here on mathematics. I think the key things we have been able to identify is the fact that when we are moving data from RAM, from any type of memory to the processor, there's always a cost in performance. Okay, if we can arrange our data effectively, we can boost the speed. Okay, by avoiding having to load and remove data from cache, we can simply make sure that data is available when needed, and it will boost the performance of an application. We've also looked at various techniques for programming. We've looked at how we can convert loops to parallel implementations using threads. The principle is always to divide and conquer. And you can simply start by parallelizing loops, and that's a very easy way to start having a parallel program. Okay. I don't know if there are any questions.
What I noticed is that to improve the performance of our HPC, apart from having these hardwares, when you are dealing with the software-wise, we have to consider the programs, first of all, on how those programs they have written so as to minimize the time of executing those programs. And also, we have to take into consideration the way we can just divide that program in such a way that we can have the same program run in different threads and come up with the same solution. So it means that we are doing this for only one node, or we are also dealing these in different nodes, which make, for instance, we have to perform this in this first cluster, the second cluster, and all sort of.
Okay, so we looked at shared memory programming. Okay, I think that's the main thing we have looked at so far. We haven't done any exercises on the programming aspects, on the program parallel programming. Most of the considerations we have been looking at are useful within one computer. So when you talk of threads, you are mostly thinking about things that are happening inside one computer. Okay, or inside one processor. So eventually we are going to extend this. The same concept can be applied to sending tasks outside of a single computer. Does that make sense?
Okay, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, okay, that's fine. But we're going to probably do so that much, later on this week, or hopefully next week. Yeah, this week is gone. Yeah, we'll probably do it next week. Hopefully we can devote our class tomorrow to maybe tomorrow we might either spend an hour looking at writing threaded applications. We can probably create a couple of applications using pthreads. We can convert our Hello World program to use pthreads. Then subsequently look at OpenMP and then do it using OpenMP. I think that's what our class tomorrow will be like. Scientific programming is mostly about it's mostly about using algorithms and mathematics. Okay, programming algorithms and mathematics. You'll discover that they are very useful in lots of places. I think if you remember the video we saw last week, movies like Shrek were produced using HPC clusters. Even movies nowadays like Avengers, or what they call it, Marvel's, superheroes and all of that. A lot of them, anywhere they use what they call CGI graphics. It's typically done using computers and HPC platforms. At the end of the day, this is just being done by solving some mathematical equations. So the way a character moves, or the way the leg moves, obeys a certain mathematical expression. So even if you are going to go into things like robotics, programming robots, getting a robot to move its leg, it's a bit of a mathematical operation. So you'll understand why we had to spend some time on mathematical algorithms. Okay.
Okay, sir.
So if you have a four-legged robot, it has to move maybe two of its legs at the same time and keep balance with the two other legs. And so this has to be done in parallel, but they are doing different things in parallel. They are moving using different trajectories at the same time. So parallel programming is also important for doing things in robotics. 3D modeling, you can also do a bit of parallel programming there. Virtual reality, augmented reality, and they all require you to be able to be comfortable with some maths. So even if you are going to be writing a financial application, working on an application that does things with money, many times you have to calculate interest, okay, and stuff like that. Those are mathematical expressions that have to be converted to software code. Okay, so maths is always important. We should not so it's important to sort of keep an idea of what's happening. Okay.
Okay, sir.
Okay, so we are more or less 13 minutes left to the end of the class. I don't know if anybody has questions or anything they would like us to address, even from previous lessons we've had this week.
I think none has questions, sir.
Okay, so we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, I'll send the recording
as soon as it's ready.
Okay, sir. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
Okay, good day.